Part 3. Love City. Maya. "What's a love child?" Maya asks. Ayers hits the brakes and they both jolt forward in the seats. It's okay. Edith is indestructible, built like a tank. "Why are you asking?" Ayers says. She seems halfway between horrified and amused. This is one thing Maya has noticed about adults. They never feel just one way. Kids, on the other hand, are simpler. They're angry, they're sad, they're bored. When they're angry, they yell. When they're sad, they cry. When they're bored, they act out or play on their phones. "I overheard someone say it, and I think they were talking about me." "Who?" Ayers says. "Who said that?" Maya doesn't want to get anyone in trouble. It was Colton Seeley's dad. He was talking to Bright Whitaker's father in the parking lot of Gift Hill, and he said something about the love child of Love City, and Maya had felt the words aimed at her. "Just tell me what it means, please." "It means what you'd think it means," Ayers says. "A child conceived in love." "But does it have a negative connotation?" Maya asks. Ayers laughs. "You know what's scary? How precocious you are. Tell me." "Well," Ayers says, "I think it's often used to describe a child whose parents aren't married. So, way back in olden days, having children was seen as a biological function to propagate the species. People got married and had children so that mankind survived. Whereas a love child is special. Its only reason for being is love." "And so that's what I am?" Maya asks. "A love child? Because my parents weren't married?" "I've got news for you, Chica. My parents aren't married either."
"They're not?" Maya says.
"Nope. They've been together a long, long time, over 30 years, but they never got officially married. And guess what? I never think about it. Nobody cares." Maya loves that she is still learning new things about Ayers. Ayers is interesting, and Maya's greatest desire when she grows up is to be interesting as well. She knows that to become interesting, she must read, travel, and learn new things. Maya is pretty much stuck on St. John for the time being, but she does love to read, and she watches a fair amount of YouTube, which is how she and Joni learn to make bath bombs. "So if you and Mick had a baby, it would be a love child?" Maya asks. "If Mick and I had a baby, it would be a grave error in judgment," Ayers says, and she turns into Scoops. "I'm getting the salted peanut butter. What are you getting?"
"Guava," Maya says.
Before she gets out of the truck, she notes that she must be growing up because she feels two distinct emotions at this moment. She is happy to be getting her favorite ice cream with Ayers. She loves Ayers. And she feels empty. Like if someone did surgery and cut her open, they would find nothing inside her but sad, stale air. Her mother is dead. Maya's mother, Rosie, is dead. Some days, Maya can't accept this truth, and so she pretends her mother is on a trip. Maybe the trip to the States that Russ was always promising but which never came to fruition. Or she pretends that Rosie and Russ made it to Anegada, have gotten a beachfront tent at the Anegada Beach Hotel, and are so smitten with the flat white sands, the pink flamingos, and the endless supply of fresh lobster that they have simply decided to stay another week. Other times, reality is dark and terrifying, like the worst bad dream you can imagine, only you can't wake yourself up. Rosie is gone forever, never coming back. Lots of people offered their support. Huck, obviously, and Ayers. Also Joni's parents, especially her mom, Julie. Julie pulled Maya aside to talk to her alone. "I lost my mother when I was 12, she said. "She died of a brain hemorrhage while she was asleep. So, as with Rosie, there was no warning.
Not knowing what to say, Maya just nodded. The no warning part was important. No warning was the worst. Leanne had died, but she had been very sick, and they'd all had time to prepare. They said goodbye. Leanne knew they all loved her. Maya worries. Did Rosie know how much Maya loved her? Did she know Rosie was the start and end of everything for Maya? Did she know she was Maya's role model? Julie continued, It's going to be hard for the rest of your life, but it'll also define who you are. You're a survivor, Maya. There have been plenty of moments when Maya hasn't felt like a survivor. There have been moments when she wished she'd gone down in the bird with her mother, because how is Maya supposed to go through the rest of her entire life without Rosie? It feels impossible. But it'll get easier, right? Maya said. Other people had reassured her that the nearly unbearable pain Maya was feeling now, worse than a side stitch, more torturous than a loose molar, would mellow with time. Maya savored that word, mellow. Yes, it'll get easier, Julie said, but certain days will be more difficult than others. Mother's Day is always tough for me. And when Joni was born... Here, Julie welled up with tears, and Maya had wanted to reach out and hug her. When I had Joni, I wanted my mom. I wanted her to see her granddaughter. I wanted her to tell me what to do. Julie had then taken a deep breath and recovered. What helped me was looking outward and thinking about the other people who missed my mom. You're mature enough for me to suggest that you keep an eye on Huck and Ayers, because they're hurting too, and they're trying to stay strong for you. But you have something they don't. You have your mother inside of you, half her genes. And as you get older, you'll likely become more and more like your mother, and that will bring people comfort. It'll be like getting Rosie back, in a way. Maya had liked that idea enormously. Her mother was alive inside of her. Maya was her own person, but she was also a continuation of Rosie. But don't put pressure on yourself to be perfect in order to make your mother proud, Julie said. She had lifted Maya's chin and given her a very nice smile. I assure you, Maya Small, your mother was proud of you every single second of every single day, just for being you. Maya has never been religious, but now it's helpful to imagine her mother and her grandmother in the sky, in a place Maya thinks of as heaven, where they lie back on chaise longues like the ones they used to relax in on Gibney Beach. Maya's grandmother, Leanne, was friends with Mrs. Gibney, and she was allowed to sit in the shade in front of the Gibney cottages whenever she wanted. I hope heaven looks like this, Leanne used to say. White sand, flat, clear turquoise water, the hill of Hawk's Nest and Carval Rock in the distance. When Maya can keep her mother and grandmother in those chaises in the sky, watching over her, cheering her on, keeping her safe, then she can move nearly seamlessly through her days. She tries to remember her mother in full, fleshy detail, because one of the things she has heard is that once people die, they fade from memory and become more of an idea than a person. Maya and her mother were so connected, so attached, that Maya can't imagine forgetting her, but she replays certain moments and images again and again, just in case. Her mother was beautiful. Short, trim, perfectly proportioned. She had cocoa skin, darker than Maya's, and a flash of orange in her brown eyes, which caused people to stare. Her eyes were arresting, Russ said once, meaning they made you stop. Maya didn't inherit the orange. Her eyes are regular dark brown like her grandmother's. Leanne claimed the orange was a small trait. It meant fire, and the fire meant trouble. Rosie worked 4 evenings a week at La Tapa. She was a great server, the kind that returning guests requested when they called to make their reservations. Having dinner at La Tapa wasn't enough of a tradition. They had to have dinner at La Tapa with Rosie as their server. Otherwise, their trip wasn't complete. Rosie knew a lot about wine and even more about food, and she liked to hang out with the kitchen crew to see how they were preparing things. Rosie was a really, really good cook, but at home she made mostly Caribbean food, recipes she had learned from Leanne and that Leanne had learned from her mother, conch stew, jerk chicken, Creole shrimp over rice. She put peas in her pasta salad and raisins in her coleslaw, just like everyone else in St. John, but Rosie's was better because she added a teaspoon of sugar. Maya is old enough to wonder if her mother had aspirations. She sometimes talked about opening a food truck, but she thought it would be too much work. More than anything in the world, Maya knows, her mother had been passionate about the Virgin Islands, the USVI and the BVI, and when she was working at La Tapa, she was always giving her tables excellent tips, such as go to the floating bar, Angel's Rest, in the East End. Don't miss the lobster at the Lime Inn, there's yoga on the beach at Cinnamon, and a really cool church service on the beach at Hawk's Nest. She could have been a tour guide, Maya thinks, or a yoga instructor, or owned a food truck. But Rosie had lacked ambition, whereas Maya has ambition to spare. She will need 2 or 3 lifetimes to reach all of her goals. Maya doesn't like to think badly about her mother, though. So instead of believing her mother lacked something, she has decided to categorize her mother as content. She was so happy with her life, in love with Russ, absorbed with Maya, good at her job, and living in a place she adored with friends everywhere she turned, that she had no reason to make any changes. Maya tells Huck about her plan for a memorial ceremony out on the water, in the place where the bird went down, and he agrees, as she knew he would. Huck has always been Maya's favorite. Her mother and grandmother loved her because they had to. Huck loves her because he wants to. Originally, she was only going to honor Rosie, but at the last minute, she chose a bath bomb for Russ as well. Maya's feelings about Russ are mixed. Maya first remembers Russ as the man with the lollipops. Flat, oval charms pops. Strawberry, Maya's favorite. Then Maya remembers him teaching her to swim at their private beach. Then, when she was 9, he let her decorate her room in his house however she wanted. But there was a part of Russ that made Maya uneasy. He didn't stay on St. John, he came and went. When he came, Maya's mother was happy, ecstatic even, impossible to bring down. And when Russ left, Rosie was devastated. It broke her every time, she said, and the leaving, the worrying that he would never be back, never got any easier. Normally, when Russ came, Rosie and Maya went to his villa. They swam in the pool or at the beach. They ate at the house. Food Mama fixed or that Miss Paulette dropped off from different restaurants. Russ liked the lobster tempura from Rum Lines and the key lime chiffon pie from Morgan's Mango. They read books and watched movies and played shuffleboard. But they didn't go anywhere. And once they returned to their own lives, to the house where they lived with Huck, Maya wasn't allowed to talk about Russ or the villa at all. She had heard Huck and other people refer to Russ as the invisible man, and it did sometimes seem to Maya that Russ only existed for Rosie and Maya. It was as if they were the only people who could see him, and Miss Paulette and her husband Douglas, and the man who came to do the landscaping and service the pool. Maya wondered how Russ got on and off the island. Did he take the ferry like everyone else? It seemed inconceivable. Maya had asked her mother, and Rosie said, "Sometimes he takes the ferry, yes. Sometimes he flies in a helicopter. Sometimes his business associates pick him up by boat down on the beach." The helicopter and private boat sounded reasonable. Maya could not imagine Russ waiting in line at the ferry dock, nor sitting on the top deck the way Maya liked to, nor disembarking in Red Hook. She thought Rosie was trying to make Russ seem like a normal person, when it was quite obvious to Maya that he was not. When Maya got older and had friends and activities and plans of her own, she started opting to stay at Huck's when Russ came. But she still wasn't allowed to talk about him or the villa or the location of the villa. "I deserve privacy in one area of my life," Rosie would say. "I don't need every damn person all up in my business. And you know that is what would happen." Maya did know. If the citizens of St. John found out about the huge villa overlooking Little Cinnamon, they would treat Rosie differently. They would ask for favors and loans, especially Rosie's small relatives. "Love is messy and complicated and unfair," Rosie would say, but only on the days that Russ left. The last time Maya saw her mother was midday, New Year's Eve. Rosie had come home from Russ's villa, where she had been staying for the past few days, solely to give Maya the last kiss of the year. Rosie looked supremely gorgeous, like a goddess, in a new cream-colored sundress, Christmas present from Russ, and a new leather and black pearl choker, ditto. Seeing these gifts made Maya check out her mother's left hand, but it was still unadorned, which Maya knew meant that, deep down inside, her mother was disappointed. What Rosie wanted from Russ more than anything was an engagement ring. Maya and Joni had been bunkered in Maya's room, making a list of tropical scents for their nascent bath bomb business, and they were also talking about a boy in their class, Colton Seeley, because Joni was obsessed with him. Joni had been Snapchatting with Colton using Maya's phone. Joni's parents were strict and protective. They treated Joni like she was 6 years old instead of 12. Joni had a flip phone for phone calls only. It didn't even text. When Rosie knocked, then entered Maya's room without waiting for a response, Maya had made a noise of protest. "What?" Rosie said. "You hiding something?" "No," Maya said defensively. She never hid anything from her mother. There was no reason to. Her mother was a very lenient and permissive parent. But Maya didn't want to give away Joni's secret. Joni only pursued her crush on Colton while she was in the free world that was Maya's house. But Joni seemed eager to tell the truth. "I'm Snapchatting with Colton Seeley," she said. "He's so hot."
"Colton Seeley?" Rosie said. "I've known that child since he was in his mama's belly. Let me see what's so hot."
Rosie had sat on the bed between them and inspected picture after picture of Colton, while both Maya and Joni snuggled up against her. Maya was happy that Joni felt comfortable admitting her crush to Rosie, and proud of Rosie for being the kind of cool mom that her friends could confide in. For those few moments on the bed, Maya's world was golden. Then Rosie stood up. She told the girls she was going to the villa, shorthand for Russ's house, and that she was headed to Anagata the next day, so Rosie was there to give Maya the last kiss of the year.
"What if we want to come to Anagata?" Maya asked.
She knew she was pressing at a boundary by asking, because Russ didn't socialize with anyone, not even Joni. But Maya thought maybe this year would be different.
"Sorry, Nut," Rosie said. "We're taking a helicopter."
Rosie had caressed Maya's cheeks and kissed her flush on the lips. "I love you, and I'll be back late tomorrow night. Happy New Year." Then she turned to Joni.
"You're right, Joan. Colton Seeley is a hottie in the making.
Bye, girls. Be good." Joni had fallen back on the bed, returning to her rapture over Colton, and so she didn't see Rosie peek her head back in the room to mouth to Maya, "I love you, Nut."
"Love you, Mama,"
Maya mouthed back. Rosie blew a kiss and was gone.
When Huck tells Maya, as they're bobbing out on the water that claimed Rosie, that Russ had another wife and other children, sons, Maya is stunned breathless. But on the other hand, it feels like Huck is telling Maya something she had already guessed. All Rosie had wanted was an engagement ring, but Russ was already married.
"They want to meet you," Huck says.
Maya has an adult moment. She wants to meet them because she's curious, but at the same time, she doesn't want to meet them because she's scared. In the end, she decides to meet them. Otherwise, she'll always wonder. But she has a couple of conditions. She wants Huck there, obviously, but she also wants Ayers there.
"This may be putting Ayers out of her depths," Huck says.
"I need her," Maya says. "The two of you are my squad."
"Joni is your squad," Huck says. "But you would never invite Joni because she's not family."
Maya considers this for a moment. When she tells Joni that this is happening, she's meeting her father's wife and his sons, who are, in fact, Maya's half-brothers, Joni will be fiendishly jealous. A secret in Joni's family is that her father, Jeff, occasionally goes to Gringo's in Mongoose Junction for carnitas tacos. Joni has to whisper, "Carnitas tacos," so Julie doesn't overhear.
"My father is only pretending to be vegan," Joni said.
"Ayers is family," Maya declares. "I need her there."
"I'll ask her," Huck says, but he still seems uneasy.
"I'll ask her," Maya says with a martyr's air. She sends Ayers a long text, the gist of which is that it has been revealed that Russ, the invisible man, has a wife and two sons, and they just found out about Maya and want to meet her, and Maya would like Huck and Ayers to go with her tomorrow after school.
"Kind of like a king needs tasters," Maya says.
She's proud of herself because she just learned about this courtly detail that very morning. The tasters sampled the king's food to make sure it wasn't poisoned, and now she is applying it to her own life. Only you won't die.
"I have work at 4, Ayers texts back initially. But then, a few seconds later, she says, "I switched nights with Tilda. Ask Huck to pick me up at home."
"Yay," Maya responds. "TYVM.
She's relieved Ayers is going, but she also feels guilty that Ayers has to miss work. Having adult feelings is exhausting, she realizes. Driving to the villa the next day, Maya is petrified. She's shaking, a phenomenon she has never experienced before, but that is beyond her control. She holds her hand out, palm facing down, and tries to steady it, but to no avail.
"Do you want me to turn around?" Huck asks.
"No,"
Maya says with more gusto than she feels. She won't back away from something because she's afraid of it.
"If it makes you feel any better, I'm nervous too," Ayers says.
"And me," Huck says.
What is Maya afraid of exactly? Last night on the phone, Joni helped Maya break it down. They were taught in school that fear often derives from ignorance. Once you understand a situation, it becomes far less intimidating.
"What's the worst that could happen?" Joni asks. "They aren't going to hurt you."
Maya had written a list.
1.
They're mean. 2. Awkward silence. 3. They don't like her. 4. They will say unkind things about Rosie. They will call Rosie names. They will say the crash was Rosie's fault. Bingo. It's the last one. Maya can't bear to hear her mother maligned by people who didn't even know her. And yet, that's also why Maya has to go. Someone has to defend Rosie's honor. Huck makes the turn. He knows where it is without Maya even telling him, and they crawl up the hill.
Come on, chipmunks, Huck says.
But his heart isn't in it, Maya can tell. He would probably be okay with the chipmunks quitting altogether. Finally, they pull into the driveway. The gate has been propped open. That never happened when Russ was here. Of course, the people Russ was hiding from are now inside the house. Maya takes a deep breath. Ayers is squeezing her hand.
You're okay, Ayers says. You've got this.
When Maya climbs out of the truck, the enormity of what is about to happen strikes her. She runs over to the bougainvillea bordering the driveway and throws up her lunch, fish sandwich. Huck hands her a bottle of water from the fishing trip supply he keeps in the back of the truck. Tomorrow, she'll tell Huck she's becoming a vegan. She'll accept only peanut butter and jelly for the rest of the year. That decision made, they ascend the stone staircase. Before they enter the house, Ayers takes in the view.
It's so weird, she says. This is Little Cinnamon, or close. The house has this view, and yet you can't see it from the road.
Only from the water, Huck says. I'm sure that was by design.
He strides right up to the slider, knocks on the glass, then opens the door.
Hello, he says. We're here.
There are three people sitting at Russ's kitchen table, a woman and two men. When Maya, Huck, and Ayers walk in, they all stand. One of the men, the really tall, good-looking one, says, Ayers?
Here we are, Huck says.
He strides over to the men and offers a hand.
Captain Huck Powers.
Baker Steele,
the tall one says. Baker. Maya has heard this name before. Then it clicks. Baker is the tourist. Ayers is tourist.
Cash Steele,
the other man says. He's shorter with a head of bushy blonde hair like a California surfer. His face is sunburned, which makes his eyes look fiercely blue.
This is our friend, Ayers Wilson, Huck says. And this is Maya.
The woman steps forward and offers Maya her hand. I'm Irene, she says. It's nice to meet you, Maya. You're even prettier than the pictures your grandfather showed me. Oh, Maya says, thanks. She gives Irene her firmest grip and manages to look her in the eye. She's old, Maya thinks, way older than Rosie. She's pretty, though in a mom-slash-grandma kind of way. Her hair is reddish-brown and styled in a braid. She's wearing a green linen sundress, no shoes. Baker looks at Ayers.
I didn't realize you'd be coming.
Last-minute decision, Ayers says. Irene says, do you two know each other? The other brother speaks up. Cash. Cool name, Maya thinks. She loves last names as first name and has long wished her name was Rainsford or Gage instead of Maya, which means Earth Mother or Goddess of Spring. It's boring and soft.
Baker and I met Ayers when we went to dinner in town, Cash says. She works at La Tapa.
Guilty as charged, Ayers says, but her tone sounds forced. Did Ayers know the tourist was Russ's son? Maya wonders. Her mind goes one crazy step further. If Ayers and the tourist get married, Ayers will be Maya's half-sister-in-law. This thought serves as a distraction from Maya's prevailing emotion, which is one of surrealness. This is the kitchen of the villa. In some sense, Maya's kitchen, or at least a kitchen where she has spent a lot of time and maybe as much or more time pretending it didn't exist. If she opens the cabinet on the far left, she knows, she will find half a dozen cans of SpaghettiOs, which Maya loves, but which Huck doesn't allow at home because he had to eat them cold out of the can in Vietnam. Now, Maya is here with Huck and Ayers. If Rosie is watching from her beach chaise in heaven, she is very, very upset. Maya is suffused with a sense of disloyalty. She's betraying her mother and her father by being here. But maybe not. Maybe Russ, anyway, is happy his two families are finally meeting each other. Maybe this was supposed to happen. Maya studies the three strangers, and she can tell they are studying her. What do they think? She wonders. Irene. The girl is beautiful, and she has a grace you can't discern from a picture. She is light-skinned. Her hair is gathered in a frizzy ponytail. She has brown eyes, but her nose and smile are all Russ, and more than Russ, they're Millie. Looking at Maya is like looking at Millie at age 12, if Millie were half West Indian. Irene needs to get a grip, offer everyone a drink, and put out some snacks, but she is hobbled by thoughts of Millie. When she goes home, which will be very soon, maybe as soon as the weekend, she will go to see Millie. That morning, she decided that she needs to tell Millie the truth. Russ is dead. Russ had a home and a second family down in the Caribbean. Irene lectured the boys about not keeping secrets, and she can't be hypocritical. Millie needs to know. Millie needs to know, too, that she has a granddaughter who so strongly resembles her. What would you like to drink? Irene asks Maya.
Ginger ale, please, if you have one, Maya says, and she places a hand on her stomach. I'm feeling a little green.
Poor thing, Irene thinks, as she pulls a ginger ale out of the fridge. This defines what it feels like to be thrown for a loop. Winnie saunters into the kitchen, wagging her tail. She heads straight for Ayers, who bends down to rub Winnie under the chin. Irene isn't quite sure who Ayers is or why she's here. She's a friend of Rosie's, maybe? If so, she may have some of the answers Irene is looking for. Cash says to Ayers, "You've never been to this house before?"
"Never," Ayers says. "I didn't even know where it was."
"I'd never been here before either," Huck says, "until the other night when Irene invited me for dinner."
"Really?" Baker says. "Didn't either of you wonder?"
"You've been here before, right, Maya?" Irene asks.
She catches a warning look from Huck. He told her that under no circumstances was she to grill the child.
"Yep," Maya says. "I have my own bedroom here, upstairs at the end of the hall."
Irene knows she's pushing her luck, but she has to ask, "Do you have any idea what Russ did for a living? Who he worked for, or what kind of business he was in?"
"Not really," Maya says. "Money or something. All I know is he was away a lot."
This last statement makes Irene laugh, but not in a funny ha-ha way. "You mean he was home a lot?" Maya blinks, uncomprehending.
"At home, in Iowa City," Irene says. "With me, his wife. Us, his family."
She nearly says his real family, but she stops herself. She will not vent her anger at the girl. The girl is innocent. She wants to ask, "Did your mother know about me? Did she know about the woman she was betraying? Did she know about Baker and Cash, Anna and Floyd? Did she know?" Irene realizes she can't ask. Huck will whisk Maya out of here faster than you can say Jiminy Cricket. However, Maya is intuitive.
"My mother used to tell me that love was messy, complicated, and unfair."
"Well," Irene says, "she was right about that.
Amen, Baker says.
Amen, Ayers says.
Amen, Cash says.
Winnie stands at the sliding door and barks.
Ayers. Thank God for dogs, she thinks. No matter how tense a situation humans find themselves in, and the situation in the kitchen of the Invisible Man's villa with his decidedly visible wife and his sons, Baker and Cash, is an 11 out of 10 on the stress scale. A dog lightens the mood. When Winnie enters the kitchen, she comes right over and buries her nose in Ayers' crotch, her tail going haywire. Everyone is trying to act normal, to pretend this visit isn't completely messed up. Irene says she'd like to talk to Huck and Maya alone, and Baker takes the opportunity to invite Ayers outside. Cash follows with Winnie.
Go away, Baker says to him, please.
Cash can stay, Ayers says. I'd actually like to talk to you both. They wander over to the pool, which is a huge two-level extravaganza with a slide and a waterfall. There's a shallow entry where they can all sit with their feet in the water. Winnie lies down between Ayers and Cash, and Ayers strokes her head.
Let me start, Baker says. I owe you an apology.
Stop, Ayers says. She marvels that her parents took her to the rice paddies of Vietnam, the red desert of the Australian outback, and the snow-capped peaks of the Swiss Alps, all with the aim of making her worldly. And still she has no idea how to negotiate this emotional landscape.
Ayers is talking now, Baker, Cash says. Respect.
Thank you, Ayers says. She bows her head and smells mixed scent on her clothes. When she got off the phone with Cash the afternoon before,
you shouldn't be interested in either one of us because we are Russell Steele's sons.
She had flipped out. She had been blindsided. But once that piece clicked, everything else made sense. Baker and Cash came to Rosie's memorial lunch on purpose, because they wanted to gather intel on the woman their father was keeping on the side. Even saying that phrase in her head fills Ayers with fury. Rosie was nothing more to Russell Steele than a side piece, a baby mama, an island wife. What can she think but that Russell Steele is a despicable human being? And yet, she has to be careful because he is Maya's biological father. The Invisible Man is also the pirate, which is sort of like finding out that Santa Claus is the Tooth Fairy. You're both liars, Ayers says, like your father. Cash holds up his palms as if to protest his guilt, and Ayers pounces. Neither of you told me who you were at the memorial reception. You let me believe you were crashing.
We were crashing, Baker says.
And then I bumped into you on the Reef Bay Trail, Ayers says to Cash. Did you follow me there?
Follow you? Cash says. No, that wasn't planned. That was a coincidence.
Ayers narrows her eyes.
I swear, Cash says. I've never been here before. I'm an outdoors person. I wanted to get out of the house, see something, take Winnie for a walk. Bumping into you was totally random. How could I possibly have followed you?
Fair enough, Ayers thinks. Maybe it was just really terrible luck. But you came on Treasure Island because you wanted to ask me questions about Rosie. Admit it.
I came on Treasure Island because I wanted to see you, Cash says. Because I thought you were pretty. Scratch that. I thought you were beautiful. And I thought you were cool. And you invited me. Sheesh, Baker says.
And you, Ayers says, you were so much worse.
I admit, we went to the reception to do some detective work, Baker says. But when I saw you, Ayers, I could barely remember my own name. It was love at first sight.
You used me, Ayers says.
The sun is directly in her eyes, so she squints, which suits her mood.
You say you like me. You say you love me. But both of you lied to me about who you were or weren't. And the thing was, I knew something wasn't right. I knew it.
She drops her voice. I never met your father, but he spent years lying to my best friend. All I can think is, not only did he have no scruples, he had no soul.
Whoa, Baker says.
She's right,
Cash says. I offer no excuses for my father. None.
Ayers wants to land one more punch.
The two of you are just like him. You're sneaky.
I called you and told you the truth, Cash says. You did not, Baker says. I did.
You did?
Cash says. I did too.
Too little, way too late, Ayers says.
She never wants to see either of them again, and this really hurts because she liked them both. She's also worried that she'll never be rid of them now because they're Maya's brothers.
It doesn't matter anyway. I'm back together with Mick.
No, Baker says.
Yes, Ayers says. I was with him last night.
She relishes saying this, even though a part of her is ashamed about taking Mick back so readily. She called him, and he was at her house half an hour later with an order of oxtail stew from De Colpot, plus a side of pineapple rice, plus one perfect red hibiscus blossom, which he stuck in a juice glass. He'd begged her for another chance. He'd made a mistake, and it would never happen again. Ayers had succumbed, even though she knew it would happen again, just as soon as he hired the next girl who looked like Bridget. But unlike these two, Mick was a known quantity, and he lived here. Tourists, she thinks, are nothing but heartbreak. Cash.
The bad news is, he can't have Ayers. The good news is, Baker can't have her either. She hates them both. It's a knockout punch, but Cash admires Ayers' principles. He would hate them too, if he were her.
They leave the pool and head back to the kitchen where Irene, Huck, and Maya are sitting at the table in silence. It feels like they've interrupted something, or maybe they came in on the tail end of a conversation. Huck stands.
We should probably go.
But wait, Irene says. The ashes. I'm leaving, Ayers says. I'll walk to the bottom of the hill and call my boyfriend to come pick me up.
I'll drive you home, Huck says. He looks at Irene. I'll run Ayers home, then I'll come back to pick up Maya. 40 minutes. Will that be enough time to do what you have to do?
Plenty, Irene says.
Cash, Baker, and Maya follow Irene down the 80 steps to the private beach. A few minutes later finds the children of Russell Steele, along with the wife he betrayed for 13 years, tossing chunks and silt into the Caribbean Sea. No one says anything. No one cries. Irene saves a handful of ashes in the bag.
I'm taking these home for Russ's mother. She smiles at Maya. Your grandmother. She's 97.
Really?
Maya says.
And you look just like her, Irene says.
Cash has tried not to study Maya's face too carefully. He doesn't want to make her uncomfortable or self-conscious, but he agrees with Irene. There is something about Maya that strongly resembles Millie. He replays Ayers' words in his head.
I never met your father, but he spent years lying to my best friend. All I can think is not only did he have no scruples, he had no soul.
Cash feels that's too harsh. He wants to think that Russ was more than just what happened down here. Russ had spent years and years providing for their family in a job he disliked, and he had always been an involved, enthusiastic father. When Cash was little, Russ would hold on to his hands, let Cash walk up his legs, and then flip him over in a skin the cat. 2 years ago, Russ had handed Cash the keys to 2 prime pieces of Denver real estate. He hadn't objected to the name Savage Season Outdoor Supply. He had even come to Denver for the ribbon cuttings. He had believed in Cash more than Cash had believed in himself. And yet, there's no denying that Russ made a terrific mess of things. The money for those stores had come from where? Cash is the first one back up the stairs. Cash may feel differently at some point, but for now, he's glad to be rid of the man. Huck. When Huck and Maya are alone with Irene, she says, "I want to talk about money."
"Maybe you and I should have that talk privately," Huck says.
Irene ignores this suggestion. "I'm guessing Russ probably gave Rosie support," she says, "and I just want you to know that I want to continue. Do you go to private school?" Maya nods. "Gift Hill." "And do you want to go to college?" Irene asks. "Of course," Maya says. "My first choice is NYU, and my second choice is Stanford. I'm interested in microlending. That's where you lend a small amount of money to help people get local businesses started. I want to help Caribbean women." "Well," Irene says. "I'm an entrepreneur," Maya says. "My friend Joni and I started a bath bomb business. They're $6 a piece if you'd like to buy one."
"I'd like to buy several," Irene says. "Let's keep the transaction simple like that," Huck says. "I'm perfectly capable of supporting Maya and sending her to college."
"Of course," Irene says. "I didn't mean to offend you."
"Not offended," Huck says, though he is a little. The emotional terrain here is difficult enough without bringing up money, although he understands that Irene is trying to provide reassurance. She isn't a witch, she isn't vindictive. Maya will continue to have what she needs.
"I don't want to impose myself into your life," Irene says, "but I wanted to meet you, as strange or unconventional as that choice might have been. I want to stay in your life as little or as much as you want me. Maybe I leave here on Friday and I don't see you again until you're on your way to NYU or Stanford. But I want you to know I'm here. And if you ever need anything, I want you to be comfortable asking me. I would be honored if you asked."
"Thank you," Maya says.
"You're leaving Friday?" Huck says.
"I am," Irene says. "The boys and I will spread most of the ashes today, and Maya, I hope you'll join us, but then I need to get back."
"What are you going to do about the house?"
Huck asks. "Nothing for the time being," Irene says. "I have a lot of decisions in front of me, but thankfully, they don't have to be made today." She reaches over to squeeze Maya's hand. "I am so glad you came today, Maya. You are a very special person."
"Thank you," Maya says. "I try."
Irene laughs then, for real, and she says to Huck, "You have your hands full with this one."
"Wouldn't have it any other way," Huck says.
Their conversation must have been far more pleasant than the one going on outside, because Ayers, Baker, and Cash walk into the kitchen looking like 3 kids whose sandcastle just washed away. Huck offers to give Ayers a ride home so that Maya can scatter the invisible man's ashes with Irene and her brothers. Irene and her brothers. Huck wonders how long it will be until he gets used to the way things are now. When they reach the North Shore Road, Huck turns to Ayers.
"You okay?"
"I guess," Ayers says.
"I'm sorry if that was awkward for you," Huck says. "Mile really wanted you there."
"I met both the boys this past week," Ayers says. "I went on a date or two with Baker."
"Is he the tourist Maya was telling me about?"
Huck says.
He's the tourist, Ayers confirms. I knew better, but I fell for him anyway. And he's leaving tomorrow.
Irene is leaving Friday,
Huck says, and he realizes he sounds wistful.
I guess it would be easier if we didn't like them so much, Ayers says.
Huck nearly clarifies that he doesn't like Irene, at least not in the way Ayers is describing, but then he thinks, why lie?
I've decided to get a tattoo of the petroglyphs, Ayers announces.
One like Rosie had? Huck asks.
Rosie's tattoo, which she got without permission when she was 15, before Huck came on the scene, he would like to point out, was just above her left ankle.
Yes, Ayers says. I used to think I didn't deserve one because I didn't grow up here. I don't have family here.
You loved someone deeply here, Huck says, and you lost her. I think that makes this home for you.
Thank you for saying that.
Ayers is openly weeping.
Would you come with me when I get it?
I would be honored, Huck says.
Irene. She sits in the same spot on the plane home, next to Cash, with a scant cup of Russ's ashes in her purse. She has been in the Virgin Islands for 7 days and 8 nights. She knows more now than she did when she arrived, although far from everything she needs to know. When she gets home, she has to call Ed Sorley, her attorney. She has to let everyone know that Russ is dead. She has to hire a forensic accountant and, most likely, a private investigator. The Virgin Islands used to be rife with pirates, or, at least, the lore of those charming swashbucklers with their skulls and crossbones and their hidden treasure. An aura of lawlessness still pervades down here. That much Irene has learned. It's as if the sun has melted away the rules, and the stunning beauty of the water and the islands has dazzled everyone into bliss. The soundtrack says it all. The weather is here. You and tequila make me crazy. One love. Before she left, Huck had insisted on taking Irene out on the Mississippi again. She knew he had, most likely, canceled a charter in order to do so. He said he wanted to give her a proper island goodbye.
If I do a good job, you might even find you like it here, he said.
There wasn't enough time to fish because Huck had to pick Maya up from school at 3, so instead, Huck gave Irene a round-the-island tour. They puttered out of Cruz Bay Harbor and headed northeast. Huck pointed out each beach and provided a running commentary.
First on your right are Salomon and Honeymoon. You'd think Honeymoon would be the nude beach, but you'd be wrong. Salomon is nude, and Honeymoon has water sports.
Irene couldn't help herself. She squinted in the direction of Salomon, but it was deserted.
There's Caneel Bay, the resort. If we had more time, we could dock and go in for a bottle of champagne.
You don't seem like much of a champagne drinker, Irene said.
True, Huck said.
They rounded the point.
On the right is Hawk's Nest, popular with the locals, although I wouldn't be caught dead there. And on the left is Oppenheimer, named after Robert Oppenheimer, father of the atomic bomb. He used to own the land. Coming up is Dennis Bay, below Peace Hill. My first mate, Adam, calls it Piece of Ass Beach.
Irene shook her head and smiled.
There's Trunk Bay, our pageant winner, followed by Peter Bay, where all those fancy homes are. And now we are approaching Little Cinnamon.
Little Cinnamon? Irene said. Where's the house?
Huck had to cut the engine and pull out his binoculars. He studied the hillside for a moment until he said,
There. The outside of the house is meant to blend in with the surrounding bush, but if you look closely and hold the glasses exactly where I have them, you'll see it.
Irene accepted the binoculars. She had a hard time finding anything resembling a house,
but then she picked out the curve of the upper stone deck. A man and a dog were outside, Cash and Winnie. They proceeded past Cinnamon to Maho, then went around Mary's Point to Watermelon Key.
Great snorkeling. We'll have to do that the next time you come.
Francis Bay, Buggy, and all the way around the East End.
Nothing out there but a great floating bar.
To Coral Bay. They headed back along the south-facing beaches. Salt Pond,
guaranteed turtles.
Lamshire Bay, Reef Bay, Fish Bay. Irene followed their progress on the map. She was awed by the size of the island and by the homes she saw tucked into crevices and hanging from cliffs. There were a lot of places to hide in St. John. Huck guided the boat toward an island called Little St. James.
"What do you like on your pizza?"
he asked. "My pizza?" Irene said. He pointed a few hundred yards away to a sailboat flying a pizza flag. "Pizza pie," the sign said. As they got closer, Irene could see a menu hanging on the mast. It was a pizza boat in the middle of the Caribbean. "Let's have a lobster pizza," she said, "just because we can."
"Woman after my own heart," Huck said. "All the pizzas are made to order, but the lobster is my favorite."
He dropped the anchor, shucked off his shirt, and swam over to place their order. Irene vowed that if she ever came back, she would bring a bathing suit. She and Huck devoured the entire pizza. Then Irene lay back in the sun. She was about to doze off when she heard Huck start the engine. "Are we leaving?" she asked. Her heart felt heavy at the thought.
"We have one more stop," Huck said.
He drove them due west, pointing out Water Island,
the little-known fourth virgin.
And then he cut the engine, threw the anchor again, and fitted on a mask and snorkel.
"Back in a sec," he said.
Irene leaned over the side of the boat to watch his watery form shimmering beneath the surface. At one point, he swam under the boat, and just as Irene started to wonder if she should be worried, though she couldn't picture Huck as the kind of man who would ever need to be rescued, he popped up.
"Got a beauty," he said.
What kind of beauty? Irene wondered. He climbed up the ladder on the back of the boat with a brilliant peach conch shell in his hand. "Oh," Irene said. The shell was perfect. It looked like something she would buy in a gift shop. Huck brought out the cutting board that he used to fillet fish, and he pulled the live conch from the shell and sealed it in a clean plastic bag.
"Maya loves my conch fritters," he said.
He then dropped the shell in a bucket of water and added bleach.
"That'll be clean by the time we dock."
"You're giving the shell to Maya?" Irene asked. She thought how wonderful it must be to have a grandfather who produced surprise gifts from the sea.
"No," Huck said. "It's for you."
It turned out Huck was giving Irene more than just a conch shell. With a few flicks of his fillet knife, he transformed the shell into a horn. He held his lips up to the hole he'd just cut, wrapped his fingers into the glossy pink interior and blew. The sound was far from lovely. It was low, sonorous, mournful. It was the sound of Irene's heart. Huck handed Irene the shell.
"Take this home," he said. "And when you need a friend, blow through it."
"You won't hear it, though," Irene said.
"No, but you'll hear it. And you'll remember that there's a tiny island in the Caribbean, and on that island, you have a friend for life. Do you understand me, Angler Cupcake?"
Irene nodded. She forced herself to look into Huck's eyes, and she thought back to her last innocent hour, 10 days and another lifetime ago, when she was at the Prairie Lights bookstore and noticed Brandon the barista gazing at her dear friend Lydia. Huck was gazing at Irene now in much the same way. She wasn't an idea or an outline, or a mere distraction from a younger, prettier woman. Huck saw her. He saw her. When Irene and Cash land in Chicago, Irene sees she has 3 missed calls from the Brown Deer retirement community and 1 voicemail. "Millie," Irene says to Cash. She listens to the voicemail. "Hi, Irene. Dot from Brown Deer here. I'm not sure if you're still on vacation, but I needed to let you know that Millie has lost consciousness, and Dr. Adler thinks it's likely she'll let go tonight." There's a pause. Irene can practically hear poor Dot trying to choose the right words. "I didn't want to have to deliver this news while you were away, but I also can't have you not knowing. Thanks, Irene, and I'm sorry. Call any time." It turns out that Millie Steele does not let go that night. She holds on until Monday morning. By Monday morning, Irene and Cash have unpacked, thrown their clothes in the laundry, and made it over to Brown Deer to take turns sitting with Millie in case there's a miracle and she wakes up. Irene and Cash have also had time to talk. Cash confided that Baker has feelings for the woman, Ayers, who was such good friends with Rosie, but that Cash likes her too. "Women always pick Baker over me," Cash says. Irene shakes her head. "Baker isn't a free man yet, and you are. You are every bit as handsome and charming as your brother." Irene brightens. "If I remember correctly, Ayers seemed quite fond of Winnie. I think you should pursue her." Irene doesn't offer any thoughts about how Cash might go about this when Ayers is on St. John and Cash is in the American Midwest. It just so happens that both Cash and Irene are sitting at Millie's bedside on Monday morning. It has been an arduous overnight vigil, and now the eerie breathing known as the death rattle has set in. It won't be long now. Irene is relieved that she has been spared telling Millie the truth about her son. Because there are no cell phones allowed in the medical unit, and certainly none allowed in a room where a 97-year-old woman is trying to seamlessly transition to the next life, neither Irene nor Cash see the calls come in from an unknown number with a 787 area code, San Juan, Puerto Rico. The call to Irene's phone comes in at 8:24 a.m. The call to Cash's phone comes at 8:26 a.m. Missed. Millie passes away at 10:02 in the morning. Dot comes in to record the time of death. "Life well lived," she says. Irene and Cash make the necessary arrangements. Millie's body will be cremated. Her ashes, along with what remains of Russ's ashes, will be buried together in the cemetery at the First Presbyterian Church once the ground thaws in the spring. "What do you want to do now?" Irene asks Cash. "Honestly," Cash says, "I want to go back." Irene nods. She doesn't have to ask what he means by back. She knows. "Me too," she says. At 8:27 a.m. on Monday morning, Baker is having breakfast at Snooze in Houston with his school wives, Wendy, Becky, Debbie, and Ellen. They had been very worried about him. Baker had been gone for over a week without warning, and they had seen Dr. Anna Schaefer herself delivering Floyd to school and picking him up. "I knew something was wrong," Debbie says. "I didn't want to pry, and Anna isn't approachable even if I had wanted to pry." Baker told his friends that his father died and he'd taken a week with his mother and brother. That's why they're all at breakfast. They want to comfort him. "Your mother lives in Iowa, doesn't she?" Becky asks. Becky is in HR and hence remembers every personal detail Baker has ever told her. "How'd you come back with a suntan?" She is also, like any good HR executive, naturally suspicious. Baker can't begin to explain that his father was killed in a helicopter crash in the Caribbean, where he happened to own a $15 million villa, keep a mistress, and have a love child. Baker also can't say a word about the beautiful woman, body and soul, that he fell in love with during his week away. He can, however, tell them the truth about Anna. They're going to find out sooner or later.
I have more bad news, Baker says. Anna announced that she's leaving me.
What? Debbie says, just as you found out your father was dead?
She found someone else, Baker says. Another doctor at the hospital.
He waits a beat.
Louisa Rodriguez.
There is a collective gasp, then some shrieking, then a declaration from Ellen that this is, hands down, the best gossip of the entire school year. Baker gets so caught up talking with his friends that he misses the call that comes into his phone from an unknown number, area code 787 San Juan, Puerto Rico, at 8:32 a.m. At 8:34 a.m. on Monday, Huck is dropping Maya off at school. They're 4 minutes late, but better late than not at all, which was what Maya was lobbying for. She was tired, they both were, because they'd accompanied Ayers over to Red Hook in St. Thomas the evening before so that she could get her petroglyph tattoo. The tattoo had taken longer than they'd anticipated, but it was a beauty, an exact replica of the petroglyphs of Reef Bay, left there by the Taino people 3,000 years earlier.
It's so cool, Maya said.
Don't even think about it, Huck said.
After the tattoo adventure, he'd treated both girls to dinner at Fishtails next to the ferry dock. Ayers had been a little subdued at dinner, as had Huck. He couldn't pinpoint the exact cause of his malaise. If it wasn't such a cockamamie notion, he would say he missed Irene. But how could he miss someone he'd only known a week? He wondered if Ayers was suffering from a similar affliction, if she missed either or both of Irene's sons. She said she was getting back together with Mick, however, she didn't sound too excited about it. Noting their glum faces, Maya had reached out for each of them and said,
I want you guys to know, I'm here for you if you ever need to talk.
She had sounded so earnest that both Huck and Ayers had been helpless to do anything but smile.
What?
Maya said.
What?
Maya is gathering her things, backpack, lunch, water bottle, when Huck's phone rings. It's an unknown number, 787, San Juan, Puerto Rico. It's probably Angela, the travel agent who sends Huck group charters, which is all well and good. He needs to get his head back into his business.
Hello? He says.
He shoos Maya out of the truck. She's dawdling.
Mr. Powers? A woman's voice says.
The voice is too young to be Angela's. She's a grandmother of 15, and her voice is raspy from cigarettes and yelling.
Mr. Sam Powers?
Yes?
My name is Agent Colette Vasco, with the FBI, sir. I've just had a call from Vizar in the British Virgin Islands. They were investigating a helicopter crash on January 1st, a crash in which your daughter was one of the deceased?
Yes,
Huck says. Reluctantly, Maya climbs out of the truck. She eyes him through the windshield as she walks to the front gate of the school.
That investigation has been passed on to us, Agent Vasco says. What was initially thought to be a weather-related incident now looks like it involved foul play.
Foul play? Huck asks.
Yes, sir, Agent Vasco says. Any chance you're available to answer a few questions about your daughter and her friend, Russell Steele?
Huck puts the window down. He needs air. He notices Maya standing at the entrance of the school, staring back at him. She senses something. Huck sets the phone down on the passenger seat. Agent Colette Vasco can wait. Right now, Huck has to tend to his girl. He is her unconditional. He is her no matter what.
See you at 3, he calls out. I'll be right here, waiting.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of Winter in Paradise. Written by Ellen Hildebrand. Read by Aaron Bennett. Produced by Dennis Kao. Directed by Vanessa Melendez. Sound edited by Jennifer Nix and Fred Koch. Mixing and mastering by Jeremy Wesley. Production supervised by Christine M. Farrell. Winter in Paradise is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2018 by Ellen Hildebrand. Audio production copyright 2018 Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental.